Here we go again.
I feel better about this time. I feel a lot better.
Okay. There.
So, he calls. It's another one of those. So, Dave, do you want to do the blah, 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 blah? I'm like, what's this going to entail, George? And,
it's going to be a cool job. What I'm trying to do, and I'll tell you what I'm after here. Hey, actually, how are you? What's going on? What's new with you? You trouble bothering people and stuff? And how's your new project? Or not new anymore. How's your project going?
That's still you, right? Your voice changed dramatically halfway through.
Yes. Now I'm Drive Time Dave with my Drive Time microphone.
Oh, very good. That was funny. Was it some kind of sound effects thing, or
no? It's
on
just
voices.
No, it's just my my USB mic does that. My
wow,
mic. I don't know why.
Isn't that strange?
No, nope. It makes me. I think it sounds more professional.
Oh, it's just killing me. I have a USB mic, but all it does is capture sound. I really like my mic. I'm very proud of it. Anyhow, I've been really busy and sick recently.
Oh, yeah?
Sick. Yeah, you can notice my nose is red.
I've been
coughing and sneezing for the last couple of days. So I haven't been to work for the last 2 days.
Have you had a chance to catch up on your reading?
Yeah.
That's what I always do when I'm sick.
No, I've started listening to baseball games now that the season has started again.
Doing this, actually,
I'm slowed down on book reading a wee bit because I'm just going straight to sleep. But other than that, yeah, I'm all caught up on Google Reader, all caught up on the email. So, yeah, I suppose that's good. So, yeah, I've been very productive while I've been sick. I did a video, and I did a photo montage and a few other things. And, yeah, it's amazing how much I can do when I'm not working.
Well, you know, those extra couple of hours in the day sure do make a difference.
Yeah. But, I've really been, it's funny, I've been busy recently on project work with NRC. Like, my real job is interfering with my work.
Well, that's no fun at all. Yeah, hardly seems fair.
So eventually stuff will come out, I assume of that, but what was that?
That was me testing my audio file.
Oh, okay.
I was testing to make sure that I had your audio coming in, which for some reason I do not.
Yeah. Well, I'm recording on this end anyway, so.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's recording. I have a brand new thing called Power Gramo, which I can use to record Skype because the, the stereo mix thing in Windows won't record my USB mic as well as the application. It'll record a standard mic, but not a USB mic. So
that's annoying.
It is annoying, and I don't know why that would be, but I've tried it three ways over Sunday, and like I say, I can do a regular mic. You just plug it into the jack, and then I can use the stereo mix to record my voice plus whatever application is playing. So I can record both ends of the Skype conversation, but it won't recognize the USB mic. So I can record either the USB mic or the application.
Oh, man. I'm not able to get either of my recording softwares to work.
Huh.
I had one and a backup ready.
Wow.
It hardly seems fair.
Well, I'm definitely recording, so I can send you the recording after if you want. We're 4 minutes and 19 seconds into it now.
Okay, well then So here's what I wanted to do, Stephen. I had two things I wanted to talk to you about.
All right.
One of them is the pad section of the 1998 document.
Oh, I should say this is audio recording only.
That's fine. Fine. The pad section of the 1998 document.
Yeah.
Because what's nice about the pad section is that,
I got the name right?
Well, that's certainly better for you. But in terms of talking about futures thinking,
mm-hmm.
it has everything in one package.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it has the conversations about looking at the trend right at the beginning, and then it talks about, you know, this is the thing that I'm seeing happening, you know, the writing and the notes, and this is how I'm identifying how things are going forward. Mm-hmm. And then it takes a shot at a scenario, and then it talks about how that scenario would play out.
Right.
And I think for the students, having that 2008 version where they see sort of, you know, somebody who they're going to know in the education field taking that shot early in their career and essentially doing what I'm asking them to do from front to back in a nice situational context, particularly with the iPad just coming out, it becomes a nice piece, you know, just a nice little concrete piece of learning.
Oh, absolutely.
So that's kind of what I'm thinking. So, well, I mean, we'll just keep playing that out then. Hal, can you tell me a little bit about your situation at Assiniboine College whenever you were asked to write this document?
Well, yeah, that's the key thing, too. I was asked. I wouldn't have written it otherwise. And basically, it was one of these things. I'm working away. And, you know, I was working on the learning management system that I was building. I just released the documentation on that. That was part of what I did in my productive sick period. I found the documentation for that and released it on my blog as a blog post, which I thought was kind of neat. And eventually they came to me and they said, you know, we know you have a plan. We have no idea what it is. And, you know, we would support you that much more if we had any clue what you were working toward. And they said that to me like the day before my vacation. So, and I don't know if they really knew me well or they didn't know me at all. I'd been working there for a couple of years by then. But basically, I went away and I spent the 2 weeks of my vacation writing that paper. And it almost comes out to a section a day. It doesn't quite, but it actually took me that long to write, and that's about the longest I've ever spent writing a paper. The only other paper I've spent that long writing was The Future of Online Learning 10 Years On.
which is really a novella at this point.
Yeah, that one took me about 2 months. That was ridiculous. Actually, I have spent a long time writing some other papers, but you know, 2 weeks to write a paper was... back in 98, it was a huge record for me. I never spent that long writing a paper. But it was one of these things where, you know, I was sort of put on the spot and challenged and told, you know, what is the plan? What is it that you're working toward? And I had the idea right off the bat that, you know, I could step through this by going from the technology, but then moving from technology to layer into it more and more the human factors. And I said at the time that I basically had two starting points. First of all, where the technology was going to go, which was actually pretty straightforward and simple. I mean, you take Moore's Law, and you apply it to a lot of this stuff, and you get the technical projections. But also the other side of it was the human element, what people would do with this stuff. And I'm coming from a background where, you know, I used multi-million-dollar global communications networks in 1980. You know, nobody had those.
Right.
But I did. I had access to one at Texas Instruments, and I used it to play chess.
Of course you did.
Of course I did. You know, the first thing I did when I was finally able to make a website, the very first thing I did was put up a page for my cat. So, you know, and it's, you know, it's the whole idea of using technology for purposes other than which it was designed. And this plays a really key role in pretty much anything. You know, almost any technology that we've ever come up with, somebody has found a way almost as soon as it's been invented to do something else with it. So I'm looking at this technology and I'm asking, you know, from the perspective of learning, especially, how are people going to want to use this? What are they going to want to use it for? I know what people are going to tell them they need to do, right? But really, what are they going to want to do? And that's the direction that I was led. And you know, you can sort of almost see the progression in the paper, starting with the technology, working through what people are going to tell them they should be doing, all the way through to, well, but here's what really they're going to do in the end. And then at the very end of the paper, here's the problems that are going to happen. Here's where the worlds are going to collide. Like the pad part is only, you know, it's early to middle of the paper.
Yeah.
The more interesting predictions are nearer the end.
There's no doubt about that. The great thing about the pad thing, though, and it really is the whole document, try to deal with the document in any conversation would take us hours.
Oh, yeah.
And I picked out the pad one because it's a discrete conversation. Yeah. It's one that we can talk about really simply without having to introduce people to, you know, vast points. Talking about the way that knowledge is changing and access and stuff is something that ends up being really difficult to talk about. But in terms of looking at trends, looking at the way that people use things and then projecting them to the future. So the third section of the document says new technology in education. And the first one of those sort of trend analysis and prediction things that you did was the pad. Yeah. Now tell us in 1998 what the pad was, Stephen.
The pad, okay. Where that was coming from, have you ever seen those clocks, and the clock is basically a clear slab of plastic and all you see is the number?
Yes, I have.
Okay. Yep. That's where it was coming from. Okay. So I'm looking at these clocks and I'm thinking these things are amazing. Because all they are is a clear slab of plastic and these numbers that change. And I'm thinking, if I could have one of those, except a bit bigger and with smaller text, this would be fabulous. Something I could read from, something I can write from. You know, my entire schooling, I've worked with 8.5 by 11 pads.
Right.
Right. And, you know, when I was doing journalism with the Gauntlet, I took notes on slightly smaller pads. I've always used pads, you know. And earlier in the paper, it says something like, what do we have? We have the pen, the pad, the chalkboard, right? So I have the pen, something to write with, the pad, and then the other invention is the WAD, the wall area display, which is also coming. We haven't quite seen it yet, but we're going to get, like, you know, real nice just wall hangings and
well we're close enough to it now that if there was a financial reason for doing it, we'd have it. The technology's there.
Yeah, exactly. They'd just be a little expensive. But even I was in the Black's camera shop, and the photos that you hang up, the digital photo frames, are now up to about 8.5 by 11, and that was selling for about $200. Still a little thicker than I like. It sticks out a little bit, about 3/4 of an inch, but moving in the right direction. So they'll get bigger and slimmer as time goes by. But the idea is, if you had, you know, the slab of plastic is, oh, I don't know, maybe 1/4 inch, not quite 1/2 inch thick. So you got to figure it's very light, right? Easy to carry around.
Yeah.
So if you have something like that's very portable, and you can read from it, you can write on it, create on it, it would do everything you needed. Well, that's what you would want.
Yeah.
So, okay, now looking at the trends and looking at that idea, how do you bring those together, right? So it's not going to have all kinds of wires. It must be wireless. And that's going to be a key thing. And I forget what else I said about it, but the key thing there was the wireless. It has to have wireless access. That way you can just carry it around wherever. But that's all there is to the pad.
And I think, you know, I'm looking through it, and I sort of took a look at this before I called Stephen tonight. And one of the nice things about the pad is that there are a couple of things that you got wrong the same way they got it wrong in the 1980s and in the 1990s about the folding part, which really doesn't work from a technological perspective. The truth is, though, it really doesn't matter.
No.
Because you look at, I just tweeted two links, two quotes, one after the other. One of them is, small 3x5 folding pads will easily fit into the jacket pocket when we take it on business trips and vacations. Yeah. And the other one is, education will truly be personal and will become truly portable. The only thing from there that didn't happen is the folding part, but that's the results
people,
of it.
Yeah, but that's because people stopped wearing jackets.
But I mean, that's how I carry my iPhone. In the Redux in 2008, you say the iPod Touch, and I couldn't agree more. It is a computer.
Oh yeah,
my iPhone is a computer, and I carry it around and I use it like a computer all the time. I take notes on it. I use it as a telephone. I use it to connect people and to read stuff and whatever. It's a computer, and it's it's smaller than 3x5.
Yeah, it's weird that they ended up smaller like that. And I think the portability has a big thing to do with it. These aren't being used so much by students as by people who are, more professional. They're more on the move. They have big computers at their desk at work or at their home anyways. They're not spending long periods of time away from their work location, like their office or their home. So they can get away with a smaller device. I still think, I'm under no obligation to give up on my prediction. I still think that for learning, the 8.5x11 size is going to be the killer size. I really do. I don't think Apple got it quite right. I think they got it wrong in a lot of ways. But I think 8.5x11, around about that size, is still going to be the size. For a variety of reasons, and it might still be folding. Who is it? I saw someone coming out with a folding one. I forget who.
But there's a great video from Apple in 1987, where they have a great vision of that sort of folding book version, where the guy jumps out with a hologram and the whole deal. But I mean, for me, the technological problems with folding over and over and over again, the hinge stuff. I mean, I'm sure we can get around it, but the cost point on that is tough. So
you're right.
Yeah, it's just that's where I always get worried with that. Whereas the nice, flat, simple, I think that you're right that the iPad missed on a couple of things because I'm not sure that I don't know who they were planning it for. Because the use case for the iPad as it is, it's a bit too heavy to carry around easily.
Yeah.
I don't know who that person is who's going to carry this thing around all the time. Because at that size, why not have a full laptop?
Yeah.
I'm just not sure.
You're absolutely right. It's too large for the amount of screen that it has. It doesn't have the input capacity that it should have.
Yeah.
And
the whole flash thing is going to hurt it.
Maybe not. I mean, I discovered the other day I can get YouTube on my iPod Touch. Something? And then I went to the Major League Baseball site because I'm thinking, well, maybe I can get baseball games on my, and they can. So,
I think they've got it doubled as H.264 for YouTube.
That's what I'm figuring. So,
yeah. I want to take this in an absolutely separate direction altogether, Stephen.
All right.
One of the things that you talk about, that I've heard you talk about many times, is where you think learning should be down the line. And I know that we've had many debates. I don't remember myself on the other side of the debate with you. I think I fall more to the anarchic side of this debate anyway. Yeah. But when you imagine that school 10 or 15 years from now, and you think of sort of picking a scenario for a school to suggest to people to think about, how would you present your sort of ideal scenario of where that school is going to be and what it does look like? Because you talk about taking down the bricks and mortar and the power structures and the hierarchies. What does that school look like?
Well, first of all, it's not a school.
All right.
Yeah, it's funny how questions can presuppose their answers.
Indeed.
I did, you remember a few years ago, a diagram came out from the U.S. Department of Education called School 2.0. I put out my version of the diagram of School 2.0. And their version was a school. It was a picture of a school all wired up, and all the students were in their school doing all their wired activities. My picture was of a small town's downtown area, and the students were scattered across the downtown doing all kinds of different things. Some students were in the courtroom. I had little cutaway pictures, right? So some students were in the courtroom. Some students were taking weather measurements. Other students were doing mapping and geography. Other students were learning to cook. Other students were studying accounting. They were scattered all throughout the entire town, working with each other and working with the adults in the town, and all connected online and all using the, you know, just the ambient internet in order to get whatever information they needed whenever they needed it. And that's the school of the future. The school of the future, you know, the ideal school of the future is no longer one where, you know, we try to cram them with a bunch of stuff that they have to learn, you know, give them the basic core, you know, reading, writing, arithmetic, as items to be memorized, but rather we present them with, you know, a whole array of possible skills and talents that they can acquire, and then they pursue the ones that are interesting to them, the ones that they have a greater aptitude toward. And so it means that, yes, you're going to find some people who aren't strong in arithmetic and things like that, but I think it also means that we'll find people who are very strong in their own chosen areas of interest. And I think we have plenty of examples where when students are given these opportunities at a young age, they turn out to be prodigies. And my feeling is that they all have the potential to be prodigies, or what we would today call prodigies. It's just that, you know, so few of them get this chance. I mean, normally we just stack them up in kindergarten or grade one class, and by the time they're there, they're lost, right? You know,
it's amazing that we think we need to teach everybody the same thing. At some level, there's something fundamentally strange about that.
Yeah, I mean, you could maybe make an argument for like grade one, grade two, maybe even grade three level education, so that they can read, write, and count some stuff.
Yeah.
You know, but when you're getting into grade five, six, seven, the idea of a common curriculum is beginning to be a bit stretched. And by the time you're in high school, it's absurd. And, you know, forget about college and university, and it has been pretty much forgotten about. But, you know, I mean, we have all kinds of examples of specialized schools in this country. Everything from, you know, the school that goes along with the Royal Winnipeg Ballet, to various hockey schools, to schools for artists, I could go on, you know. And these opportunities exist, and they are producing prodigies in all areas, but only for such a small minority of children. And so the ideal school of the future is that kind of opportunity for everyone, where you can connect with and begin working with at an early age the type of discipline or the type of area that really interests you.
That's great, Stephen. That those are the two pieces I was looking for. Those are perfect.
Cool.
Yeah, man. So get better, eh?
I will. Do you want me to email you this
recording? Please do, yeah. That'd be great.
All right.
And if you do happen to think of any other stuff I can add into this, that'd be great, because I'm still trying to throw together this course on short notice. And
On
futures thinking, generally.
You know, of course, it's a very large area. You've
sure
done the Toffler stuff and all of that, I'm sure. I hope. Toffler is very interesting. I like Toffler a lot. I was so influenced by Toffler, I don't know, 20 years ago. So I think reading Toffler sort of got me thinking this way.
Yeah, he's on my... I don't think I've actually read the articles that I have from him that are on my list.
Oh, yeah. They would have been a lot more useful 20 years ago, but they should be good reading now. It was so worthwhile, especially the third wave. Future Shock was...
Now I know who this guy is.
Yeah, Future Shock was the book that made him famous, but the Third Wave was where he was like rock solid. And you go read the Third Wave, and people make a lot of fun of him now because not everything came true, but my view is, well, not enough time has passed. So.
Well, yeah, but I mean, at some point, that's like making fun of Asimov because a lot of the things he thought were wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, but a lot of the things that he thought became true because he thought them as well.
Well, yeah. Although it's the funniest thing is, you know, the Foundation series with the mule, who predicts a future history. Some people are saying, yeah, well, we've got that now. And Osama bin Laden, he just made a bunch of recordings. He was killed early on, but the recordings survive. And they just pull out the appropriate recording whenever there's a world event. They pull out the appropriate Osama recording, you know, so... Yes, we knew your plane would crash because we caused it, you know, or whatever, you know.
And now it's, you know, just chopping the language. We knew your airplane would crash.
Yeah. So, I mean, just, it's possible.
It is possible.
Actually. It is possible. What else? I don't know. Some stuff by Harlan Ellison, maybe. There's a book I read recently called Future Imperfect. That's not by him, but it's a collection of dystopian futures. I mean, that's the thing. People, when they think about the future, they tend to idealize. And they shouldn't.
And I don't think that'll happen so much in this course.
Oh, that's good, yeah.
Yeah. I have a funny feeling that it's not going to work out that way. It was one of the things they're about to go into strat planning at their university, and this is kind of their prep before strat planning.
Right.
So I'm trying to get them to that point where we're looking out 10 to 15 years instead of 2 to 3 and saying, okay, you know what? If you're going to plan for this stuff, one, you've got to accept these possible futures. You've got to accept that you're not going to know which is which. But you got to look at them all and say, okay, there's some of these things that no matter what scenario we put together, some of these things are inevitable.
Yeah,
the ones that are inevitable, you can deal with.
Yeah. Was it you or somewhere else I was reading that futurism has shifted from actually projecting a future, which we're told is very imperialistic, to and very, what's the word I'm looking for? Inevitabilistic, fatalistic, you know what I mean? To projecting scenarios that allows for the people of the future to have some choice. And I don't like scenarios. I really don't. You know how when you project the future, and The Economist does this, right? The dystopian future, the get their act together future, I don't like it because to me that's cheating. because you're still making these calls, but you're kind of hiding it behind these scenarios. You're still predicting what's going to happen, but you're kind of fudging it. And yeah, it's cheap.
I think if you're doing it and saying that this is the way you look at the future, and then you use it later as an excuse for not, like if you predict everything, then yes, you're likely to going to be right. What I'm trying to do with the scenario planning that we're doing, one, we're going to do exploratory scenario planning first and then normative scenario planning. So I want them, one, to just take a look at some possible futures and see the links between them, because these people aren't going to have done this before, right?
Right, yeah.
And just if they can look at it and say, no matter how we look at this, that mobile and personal thing is coming.
Yeah.
Because it's really tough to do a future scenario right now that doesn't include that. Yeah. And if you start to see it pop up all the time, it starts to occur to you that, you know what, there's no hiding from this.
Yeah, it's pretty much part of the constant background.
It's pretty much a constant in the way that it's going to go.
Yeah.
And then what you do is you start sifting out those constants, and then you do your normative planning, and you say, okay, there are some constants we're pretty sure they're going to come along. What do we want to build from this?
Yeah.
And then you take your shot.
But the other thing, too, is, you know, I mean, these are people from an institution doing this planning.
Yeah.
They always assume the institution will still be there.
Yeah,
and even more to the point, should still be there, and
yeah,
very often that's not the case.
especially in the next 15 or 20 years.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You can't tell me Acadia is going to be there in 15 years.
It's questionable. and people are still denying it, although, you know, I've read something like 15,000 teachers laid off in California. You know, sooner or later that has to hit, you know.
Well, you know, I was talking to the dean of arts at my university about this today. Yeah. They had a job application for an economics professor. Last time they got 30 applications. This time they got 162.
Yeah, that should tell you something. Yeah.
You know, in the history colloquium, the big one in the States where all the history profs go to look for jobs.
Yeah.
Last year they got I think it was like 1,000 fewer job offers this year.
Yeah.
Like the whole field is constricting.
Right. Yeah. And do you see this getting better?
No.
Ever?
No, it's not going to get better.
So
why would it?
Why would it? Half
of these people were just knowledge holders.
Right.
We don't need them.
Right. Exactly. So this is the other thing about predicting the future too. People are always going to be happy to say you're wrong. but when you look at things and they're really obviously going to be the case, it doesn't matter if people say you're wrong. And sometimes you have to stick to your guns, I guess.
Never been a problem for you, Stephen.
No. you'd think. It has from time to time. But, if it had never been a problem for me, I never would have written Future of Online Learning.
Well, there you go.
There you go. You're doing this in Singapore?
In Singapore, yes.
Is this a guy called Sarah Van Ann?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm doing this for George.
Okay.
It's the last course in that bloody certificate of his out in the university doesn't work for anymore.
Okay.
And his last course, this is one of those great situations with him. Yes. I said I wasn't going to be able to do it, and then I found a way I could do it, and because I'd seen the title, and I went, you know what, this may be really interesting.
Oh, I'm sure it is.
And then I got, where's the blog post? I got this written on my friggin' blog. I got the course from them, and this is the only thing they had. I'll Skype you this over here. This is what I had. This is the course.
Hang on, it's hidden. What is the wave of? It's hidden. I can't see it. Ah, here we go. What is the next wave of technological change? What can educators do to prepare and anticipate trends? Using a method. Oh, isn't that interesting? Called future thinking. This course will look at a variety of trends and provide a series of potential. Blah, 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 blah. Yeah, that's funny.
And I'm looking at it, I'm thinking, you want me to do what and who now?
Yeah. the reason why I asked is when I went to Kuala Lumpur, it was a seminar put on by a guy called Sarah Van Ann. He was a very interesting guy, nice guy. He's from India.
Yeah.
And he organizes seminars basically in that arc from Dubai and the Mideast from across India to the Far East, Malaysia, Singapore, and even some in Australia. So I did one for him, and then he asked me to do another one in Dubai, but right at a time when I was conflicted, otherwise I would have done it. So I was just curious if it was the same guy.
No.
So the other reason that I was wondering about the timing was because you're doing a 4 or 5 day course in the future. I'm thinking, well, gee, that would make 5 great issues on the newsletter, and I've never done anything like that before, but that would be fun. But the timing doesn't look good. I don't know when in April you're doing it, but I'm supposed to fly off to Finland in late April.
It's 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th.
Oh, well, that timing is good.
Yeah.
Because, I just take 5 days of the newsletter and just devote them to that course, right?
That'd be really fun.
There'd be all kinds of resources in that for that course. You can send me resources, and I can just have the whole newsletter follow along.
Perfect. That sounds like fun.
All right, good.
Let's do it. Okay. All right. So,
this is me jumping in on a good idea.
There you go. All right. Well, thanks for your help, Stephen. I appreciate it.
No problem. And how important is quality on that audio?
I mean, it's got to be listenable, but I'm not too worried about it.
All right. 64, I guess.
That's fine. 64 is lots. Yeah.
All right. Good.
Thanks, bud.
I'll do that.
Okay.
Talk to you later.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.